This is lecture 35. We've been dealing with the free relativistic scalar field, and we determined that the expectation value of the two-point function, which we called g of x minus y, had the following properties. I'm just going to take the leading or most important part of the singularity structure today. I'm not even concerned with numerical factors. This is the behavior for small x or small mx. And in two dimensions, this was minus natural log of mx n equals 2. Notice that there was a 1 over 2 pi, which I'm ignoring today. There were more complicated factors here. We are dealing with a sketch of quantum field theory. I want to eliminate as many of the complicated combinatorics and numerical factors to try to get to the essence of the matter. Okay, one last thing before we change subjects. We have actually been calculating this quantity. In a Gaussian, indeed normal measure, and we found the answer was given by 1/2 integral j g j dn y1 dn y2. By expanding this in power series, I will get, let's call it, I observe first only that the even ones survive, because this is even in J, so the odd terms all vanish. So expand this into power series, I get I to the 2L factorial. Summation J1 J2L. I've got a very brief schematic here. Expectation phi 1 phi 2L. I'm not even writing the dx's. That's understood. That's the left-hand side, nor the integral signs. On the right-hand side, I have minus 1/2 to the s, summation on s, divided by s factorial. And then I have j1 left, j2 left, s left, js right. I am recognizing that the j's come in pairs. I'm calling it left and right. This is the first term of that. Then I have S of these terms, exactly. And then I have phi 1 left, phi 1 right, up to phi S left, phi S right, expectation value. Now there are two S of these terms. I don't want to do that actually. I'm sorry, that's not what I wrote at all. I want to write the G's. G one left, one right. G two left, two right. G S left, S right. Sorry, thank you. Okay, so I equate like powers of J. There are 2L over here and 2S here. So that means I will equate L and S together to get equivalence. That's an even number, so that becomes minus to the power L, 2L factorial. I'm going to pick out that particular term now, J1, J2L, Phi1, Phi2L. Over here, L will equal S, so I pick out L factorial. The 2 downstairs becomes 2 to the power L, minus 1 to power L, J1 left, J1 right, L left, JL right, and G1L, 1 right, up to G left, sorry, L left, L right. Okay. So, if, now remember, all these have integrals here and all those integrals. So I want to take the J's away from this. That will give me a minus 1 to the L over 2L factorial. And then I have the multipoint function. So I have phi of x1, phi of x2, up to phi of x2L. On the right-hand side, that's minus 1 to the L. We could have gotten rid of that one already. Over 2 to the L, L factorial. And then I have G 1L, 1R, GL left, L right, with a kind of an average. Average meaning that this thing is absolutely symmetric in these 2L arguments, just as this is symmetric in the 2L arguments, because of the J's, for example. But clearly this thing is also symmetric in the 2L arguments. This is symmetric in the 2L arguments here. And when I say average, what I mean by that is I am doing that average, and you'll see exactly more what I mean in a moment. Okay, so clean up a few of the numerical factors, and this equation becomes this. So I have a 2L factorial upstairs. I have a 2 to the L factorial downstairs. And I have G1L, 1R, GL left, LR average. Let's take a very simple example here to see what I'm really talking about. Let's take L equals 2. Example, L equals 2. So I have the four-point function, phi x1, phi x2, phi x3, phi x4. Indeed, when we were talking about either Brownian motion or Ornstein-Uhlenbeck processes, we discussed the four-point function there. The argument was only time only. Now it is space and time, but the argument is the same. If I choose L equals 2, then this number is 2L factorial, that's 4 factorial, divided by 2 to the L, 2 squared, L factorial, 2 factorial. So that's 24 divided by 4 times 2 is 8, or 3. So that's equal to 3 times this average. And so now I go out to 2 of those, 2 left, 2 right. Okay, let me start averaging. The average would be phi x1, phi x2. Two of those make a g, phi x3, phi x4. What I now have to do is symmetrize. Phi x1, phi x3, phi x2, phi x4. And one more term to symmetrize, phi x1, phi x4, phi x2. two five is three. Now, in point of fact, if I was really crazy about symmetrization, I would also symmetrize the one and the two, and the three and the four. But those are already symmetric, so I don't have to do that. Now, this quotient, in order to make my average, I divide by three. That's my symmetrization. But I am multiplying by three. These two numbers cancel. Could it be that whatever this number is, it will always have this cancellation? So let's figure out what this number really is. I have two L indices on the left-hand side, and I must symmetrize over that. So that means there's two L factorial possible ways to spread these indices down on the labels of the G. But every pair that hits on a G is already symmetric. So it doesn't matter whether I hit here first in this one or the opposite order. So I am dividing then by two for each of those G's, and there are L of those. So I divide by two to the L to account for the fact that I didn't need that symmetrization. But then I have, it doesn't matter whether I put the G to pair on this one or on the next one, or on the next one, those are all symmetric too, so I divide by another factor, which is L factorial, saying it didn't matter which G they landed on. So that's indeed my very similar factor, my same factor right here. And we learn basic property. I now write it in a little simpler notation. Sum of all possible pairings without any numerical factors whatsoever. So A, phi B, phi C, phi D, all the way out here, all possible pairings. And a nice convenient way to do that is to represent a given term in here. Here's 17, let's say, and here's phi 2L out here. Let's represent a given term here by little arcs over these. So these two I'm pairing. These two I am pairing. And more arcs, until I fill out all the necessary terms, and then I would have the sum of all those possible ways to draw that little arc. I believe in the physics literature this is still called Wick's theorem, although it's an elementary property of Gaussian functional integrals. It means that we can calculate the correlation function of an arbitrary monomial in the fields by means of sums and over products of the two-point function. Of course, all the odd terms, odd things that would have to be down here would be zero, because I can't pair up an odd number. I would have one left over. Okay, that's going to be a powerful tool in what we do next. All right, so now we pass to 7.3, which talks about interacting theories. We have done the free theory. Let's look at it again. Remember, H bar equals C equals 1 in this chapter. We have a J x phi of x d n x plus an I, we have an I already, integral 1/2 relativistic square for the field m squared minus I epsilon phi squared d n x curly d phi. This number we know what that is, we've just computed it. That is indeed nothing but e to the minus 1/2, actually I, of x. Now, I'm going back a little bit, involving the Feynman function, j of y, and x d of y. I would like to insert a potential. And we did this briefly in our study of the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. Let's do it again. I'm going to introduce a quartic potential. So I will do that by taking a functional derivative with respect to J, whose purpose is to introduce a phi in the place of that, because derivative with respect to I times delta J will give me strictly a phi. Phi of x raised to the fourth power, that will now be inside the integrand. I put in a coupling constant in front of that called lambda, which will be the strength of that particular term. So that would be something of the following form, n e to the I integral j phi. Let's put it all in one one term. D mu phi squared minus m squared minus I epsilon minus lambda phi to the fourth end of bracket dn x d phi. Now, one thing is wrong. This quantity is already normalized. That's how I've chosen script n. So that when j equals 0, I get unit. When I act on it with this extra term, I'm going to have a different integral to do. So the same old coefficient is not going to work anymore. And so I'm going to have to put in, to take out this other factor and put in a new factor, so that I have a factor here, n prime, which is arranged so that this thing will equal 1 if j is identically 0. So this new normalization is done to choose chosen to do that. Well, this gives us a prescription. It's not a prescription we're going to follow at the moment, but it is one that people have done and do. They will let this quantity act, not on the functional integral like here, but on the answer of that functional integral, which is given right here. This is the answer to this term above. Acting on it then with this quantity, I won't write it again, but bring it down here to act, adjust the normalization as needed, and that will account for the introduction of the additional phi to the fourth potential. I'm not saying that's easy to do. Typically, people will expand this in a power series of lambda and let it work term by term by term as a perturbation series. We're going to do something very similar to that, perturbation series of a different, slightly different kind. Oh, just what I wanted to keep. Well, you have it in your notes. Okay, the same story can be done with the Euclidean formulation as well. Euclidean interacting theory. This time, I will take j phi dnx, and I will pass to the Euclidean version, imaginary time, for the free field, and act upon that with my functional derivative, now without the same number of i's outside at least. With the normalization, I'll put in n prime already, ready to account for the final answer. Of course, this n prime and that n prime are not the same because we've changed the integrand. But in principle, this gives you a related but somewhat different integral to deal with than the one that involves strictly the phase factor formulation over there. And again, this n prime is chosen so that when j goes to 0, we get unity. Ideally, and in certain cases I will illustrate or tell you about, this has in fact been proven, ideally, this should be the Fourier transform of a genuine measure. We knew that already for the free theory by itself. We talked about that. The answer we had, which I write down in the middle here, e to the minus 1/2 j of x, g of x minus y, j of y, dnx, dny, and then this term would as well act on this. This term was a function of positive type and was continuous, so that we knew was the, by the Bach-Vermin-Lowe's theorem, was the Fourier transform of a measure. By all rights, this should also be the Fourier transform of a perfectly well-defined probability measure. And in two cases, I will talk about what they are in a little bit later, this has actually been proven to be the case. All right. And again, we could try to act with this form of the derivative, acting on this term in order to fully study the interacting theory. Again, people tend to do that by expanding this in a power series and moving forward. We're going to go direct to a perturbation calculation of a slightly different type. And I to warn you that this will not have the proper numerical factors. We're going to just say it's a sketch. And in some ways, what we say for the rest of the lecture probably will be the most important thing you've heard in weeks. So pay attention. Here's what we're trying to calculate. E to the I J phi DN, let's call them Y. We have minus 1/2, we're going to do it in the Euclidean world, gradient phi squared plus M squared phi squared DNX plus, or actually minus, our interaction term. I want you to leave some lines. We're going to multiply that by another term, which I don't write yet. That's e to something, which is to come. There's a third line, which is also e to the something, which will come later. And at the end of that will be the integration over the phis. And, of course, whatever formal constant I need to do. We're going to come back and fill in some terms here. We study that by expansion in powers of J and lambda. So we're going to expand this term in a power series and this term in a power series. That's going to leave us something of the following form. E to the minus 1/2 gradient phi squared plus m squared phi squared, dnx, d phi. And then I will have these terms expanded and these terms expanded. That's a lot of terms to look at. But I want to focus on specific terms. So this is example one of the terms we are focusing on. There's going to be two J terms. So that means there's a phi of Y1 and a phi of Y2. And there's going to be two of these terms. So that's going to involve lambda squared and phi to the fourth of x1, phi to the fourth of x2. I am not paying any attention to the factors that would come. This would be a 1 over 2 factorial expansion here. This would be another 1 over 2 factorial. All of these numbers are important. And when you want to calculate precise values of these things, you'll need the numbers. I want to get the qualitative behavior of the answer. This is an expression of the form. By the way, I have my normalization, of course, where I am dealing with phi 1 up to phi 4 and 4, 8, 9, 10. So I have 10 fields in my expectation value. That 10 term things will have all of these double things that you can hook together. I don't want to talk about all of them. I want to focus on one of those many terms, or one representative from those many terms. I want to pretend the y1 point is here, the x1 point is here, the x2 point is here, x1 there, x2 here, and the y2 point is over here. I want to connect those two. So I take one of the phis into this bunch, and one of the phis into that bunch. Now I have three phis at x1 left over, three phis at x2 left over, and I join them all in pairs. Now there will be some combinatorics in that. Which one of these do I choose to connect with? I'm not worried about that. So I will have three lines which connect x1 and x2. What is left is that these things correspond to the G's that couple them. So there's something going to be proportional to lambda squared. I don't worry about the J's now. This is Y1 to X1. This is X2 to Y2. That comes to the G to the first power, G to the first power, because there's a single line. And here G, X1, X2 comes cubed, because there are three lines which do that. I integrate over the x1 and the x2, that was already part of these integrals when expanding, and I'm interested in that expression. What about the y's? Yes, the y's are integrated against the j's, but the j's, I will assume, are smooth, localized functions. They keep the y variables near the origin. So the x1 cannot get too far away from the origin because the functions fall off. The x2 cannot get too far away from the origin. It will fall off. So the x1 and x2 variables live near the origin. This term will go like 1 over x1 minus x2 cubed. I have unfortunately erased it, but cubed n minus 2. That's how it goes whenever n is 3 or greater. It would go as a logarithm of m x1 minus x2 cubed in n equals 2. Logarithms to any power are singular, but they are integrable. There's no difficulty in dealing with those integrations. On the other hand, this guy leads to dangers. So I'm going to pass away from the n equals 2 situation and tell you that there are effectively no difficulties in 2 space-time dimensions. Difficulties begin at n equals 3 and above. This term is singular along this line when x1 equals x2. How singular? Well, let's go to suitable coordinates. So imagine, just imagine, we're not going to really do it. Imagine changing variables to the difference variables. Let's call x now x1 minus x2. So we have a 1 over x to power 3n minus 2. And I make a Jacobian to the sum and difference variables. These will have something perpendicular to that and something along that direction. So that will be dnx. That's what I'm dealing with. This integral diverges whenever 3n minus 2 is greater than or equal to n. It will be a logarithmic divergence at equality. It will be a power law divergence otherwise. Take that n to the other side. That's a 2n greater than or equal to 6, or n greater than or equal to 3. That's where we begin getting a divergence from this particular graph, this particular term in this computation. For example, suppose this is going from, I'm in radial coordinates, so I'm only worried about the radial variable. This is going from 0 to infinity, then this will diverge whenever n is greater than or equal to 3. Let's see if we can estimate or determine the strength of that divergence. So what we do is regularize, so-called. That is, we back away from the full theory and we soften it some way. So I'm going to put in a lower cutoff of the radius, call it epsilon. Dnx going up to 3, I beg your pardon, infinity, x to the 3n minus 2, and I'm sticking to n greater than equal, n greater than 3 here. We'll talk about equal 3 in a moment. So I'm trying to estimate that. Well, I've removed the singularity at the origin, and if n is now bigger than 3, as stated here, this thing will converge at infinity. So the fact that x1 is actually rushing out to infinity is not a danger for me to consider, even though we already know that x1 is nearby y1 and y1 is localized because of j. Okay, so all I need to do is do one of my famous coordinate transformations. Let x squirt out an epsilon. That means the limits do the opposite, so that's a division here. So that's 1 to infinity dnx over x to the 3n minus 2. But I pick up an epsilon to the n in the numerator, and an epsilon to the 3n minus 2 in the denominator. Cancel those epsilons and you find 1 over epsilon to the 2n minus 3. 1n combines with the 3n to make me a 2n, but the minus 6 has got to stay. So this is the approximate behavior, and even more, this is the behavior and an approximate estimate of the numerical kind of coefficient. Of course, there is the lambda squared that goes along with this, and let me now introduce that. Lambda squared over epsilon to the 2n minus 3 times this numerical factor, 1 to infinity, dn and x. x, 3n minus 2.
It's 2n minus 3. 3n minus 2. The constant is 6.
The constant is still 6. The numerical value is still 6, but I reduce one of the n's, and so that gets to be beautifully rewritten as 2n minus 3. Question?
Yeah. I'm confused. You had two integrations on x, dx1 and dx. You had two integrations on x, dx1 and dx2.
Sure.
Then how did you lose one of those integrations?
Well, the dn x perpendicular in this direction here will not see a singularity from this and will be confined by the limits of the y, which are the limits of the j. So that's just a finite range integral.
Okay, so this is giving me a true divergence in the calculation. That's serious. That's really serious.
If there were no divergences, which is the case when n equals 2, one space, one time dimension, then the integral is essentially well defined, and I will explain what is rigorously known about this integral in two dimensions. But when I have n equals 3, this term will contribute a divergence. An infinity is not welcome in a characteristic function. So I must find a way to deal with it. Let's take another look at my extra term. My extra term, going back to x1 minus x2, and I'm going to pull out the coefficient in front, epsilon to the 3, n minus 2, there.
Excuse me, John, where did you go back to here? You said you were going back to something that I lost it.
What did I go back to?
You said, let's go back to something and start writing again, and I don't know where you're picking up.
Did I say that recently, or
just a sentence and a half back before you start
writing
those characters?
Okay. I'm going to go back to look again at what is actually happening here a little more closely because of this term. I claim this singularity, apart from a coefficient, that this singularity is like a delta function. It is like a delta function. Now, it's not strictly a delta function, because the integral of a delta function is unity. The integral of our term, however, has an extra singularity. So I might say it is like this kind of a function. It's like a delta function in that it only is singular when the line x1 and x2 coincide. It is otherwise relatively harmless when x1 is different from x2. So I'm going to say that this thing is approximately represented by this kind of term. Now I'll take the quotation marks away around the delta function and say that if I was able to subtract this quantity from my contribution here, g, g cubed, g, if I could subtract that, then I would be able to remove that infinity. In particular, let's take it like as follows and say I would have g of y1 minus x1 with a minus sign, that's my subtraction, delta of x1 minus x2 and g of x2 minus y2 dnx1 dnx2. So here I am now subtracting my delta function. But unfortunately, this was not a perfect delta function. It was a delta function that even got stronger. So I have to put in an extra coefficient, 1 over epsilon to the 2 n minus 3 in front of that. Now I have captured the fact that this one will diverge with this strength and with this kind of singularity, and I've just plain subtracted that. And with good luck, I do have the good luck, it turns out, I have canceled the singularity and what is left here will be better behaved. What I need is a counter term
in my original problem, which creates this. And here is, we enter the first line. I'm going to put in a minus a half delta m squared integral phi squared dnx. This term is rather like the mass term here. It is a counter term in that it did not appear in the original Lagrangian. It's on this line down here. Let's see what that would contribute to my integral. So that term would be a phi y1, phi y2, and then there would be a phi x1 squared that I would get by expanding this out in the line. And instead of these terms, I include one of these terms along with those. So I'm replacing these eight phis by the two phis here with a suitable coefficient. We'll talk a second about the coefficient. Well, what is this? I'm interested in this particular situation. So that is exactly g of y1 minus x1, g of x1 minus y2. And of course, that's exactly what this is. What if this integral dx2 will eat up the delta function and bring the two g's together? So this will exactly do what I want. What do I need, however, about the delta m squared? I need the delta m squared. Maybe if I put it over here. That's the only place it's ever appeared, so we better do it here. Side issue. Delta m squared is proportional. Again, I'm not dealing for you with the numbers. Lambda squared, because it's canceling this particular term, which has two lambdas, and it has to have this accentuated magnitude of epsilon to the 2 n minus 3.
That's just a disorder.
What, can you get?
That's just a disorder.
So the question is, this cancellation occurs only to this order. You're absolutely correct. I've only canceled the first appearance of this kind of divergence. And it is a horrendous computational and combinatoric problem to prove that all the other needed cancellations can be done by a few terms of this kind. One other term this is proportional to, which we haven't introduced, is h bar. Our h bar is unity. But this is important for us to remember that this is proportional to h bar, because when we take the classical limit of this theory, that is, we haven't done this seriously in this course, but if we looked at the stationary phase approximation or the steepest descent approximation to this theory, then we would be looking for h bar going to zero asymptotics of that theory, but this term itself, the correction term, would be disappearing at the same time. This is a consequence of quantum mechanics. It does not appear in the truly classical theory. And when h bar goes to zero, we go back exactly, ideally, to the original action. Okay, so that is the prototype of the first infinite renormalization we need to do. This is mass renormalization. And I will quote for you at the end, or at some point, that for in three dimensions, three space-time dimensions, this is the only term, the counter term you have to consider. And it is rigorously proved that this term plus these terms do go to a bona fide, well-defined measure in field space, a countably additive measure, probability measure, in the field space in three dimensions, along with this correction here. Now, of course, there's some limit on the outside as epsilon went to zero, because this has to be dependent on defined with epsilon, as well as my little propagator, or the original term here, has got to allow for this cutoff here as epsilon goes to zero. By the way, this epsilon
is not to be confused with the epsilon we had previously, m squared minus I epsilon. There's just not enough Greek letters, which are naturally small. Okay. Now, what we want to do now is to climb up the scale, go to higher and higher n values, space-time dimensions. We want to find further sources of infinity, which we must introduce countercharges for. Yes, question?
The interval over here, you said diverges for n equals 3.
Oh, yeah, okay. Thank you. Talk about the n equals 3 case. N equals 3, our original integral here was n equals 3, that's a 3 upstairs, d cubed x. Down here, 3 minus 2 is 1, so that's an x cubed downstairs. The lower limit is going to give me a logarithm. Therefore, I need to cut that off with an epsilon. So that will be like a minus natural log of epsilon. Unfortunately, I cannot place the upper limit at infinity because that is a second divergence. The natural log also diverges at plus infinity. But that shouldn't worry me because x never reaches infinity. X, like x1 and x2, is confined within this smooth region as determined by the J's. So all I have to do to approximate what happens for n equals 3, where is my little calculation, is to put on any cutoff I like, m, x, and then call that infinity. So now infinity is safe. This is my natural logarithm down here. This will give me some numerical coefficient that in a serious calculation I would have to carry forward. But the natural logarithm is the essence of that. So my problem here would be proportional to lambda squared and a logarithm of epsilon in the numerator here, where n is still an h bar. Okay, we have 2 minutes left, and I think that's time enough to not get further. We'll meet on Monday and continue this story. Further questions, of course.